And now, Spotlight Montana with Laurel Staples.
October 17th, 1991. That's when a Missoula teenager vanished after using a payphone at a gas station in Demi, New Mexico to talk to her mother. Fast forward to 2021. On April 4th, Jennifer Pintella would have turned 48. And now, on this 30th anniversary of her disappearance, Montana author Brian D'Ambrosio dives into the case. He just got back from New Mexico, where he retraced her footsteps. In the Spotlight Montana, he shares with us what he discovered and the hopes officials will take another look at this case.
You just got back from New Mexico. Your findings were just published in an article in the Montana Press. Great article. Fascinating to read through that. First, describe to me what Jennifer was like.
Well, I think Jennifer Pintella would be the perfect child and the perfect daughter. I think she was the type of kid that anyone would be proud to be her parent, to be their her parent. She was bright, ambitious, intuitive, kind, empathetic. She had all the attributes and qualities that anyone would want in a partner or a friend or a child or a neighbor. And she was very, very sympathetic. It seems she was born with this, an intense sense of religiosity, maybe an intense sense of purpose. She was in the process of maybe dedicating her life to something bigger than herself. So she was, deeply caring, compassionate, kind, and interesting human being. She was also quite adventurous too. When she was in high school, she'd been to Africa to do some missionary work. The summer of July, 1991, in July of 1991, during the summer of 1991, she was in Mexico repairing churches and working with an aid group. So she was, she had a sense of spirit, a sense of identity, and a strong sense of compassion for other people.
So very familiar with traveling on her own. This was not unusual for her to be taking this trip to New Mexico and California. She was born in Butte, right? And then went on to Great Falls.
Her parents were born and raised in Butte as well, and then she went to high school in Great Falls, and then after she graduated from high school in Great Falls, she went to Missoula and lived in Missoula.
So take us through the timeline of this case.
Well, we can start in October of 1991. We'll start on October 1st, that when Jennifer and her bicycle board a plane from Missoula to San Diego, and her plan would have been to meet up with a group of missionary workers on a trip that they were going to be taking to Mexico. There were some complications beforehand, so Jennifer didn't get the opportunity to depart with them. So her plan would have been to hop on the plane from Missoula and go to San Diego on October 1st, 1991, and spend a day or two camping, riding her bicycle, and meet up with them and meet up with the group, and then either meet up with them somewhere north of the border or meet up with them south of the border. So it seems as if in her journals that she'd arrived in San Diego and she made several stops. In California, she met up with some people that she knew from previous trips, coincidentally and serendipitously, met up with some friends, people that she'd already done some other missionary work with. And so the time frame is a bit nebulous and a little murky, but it's also has been illuminated by her journals, which were discovered in 1992, and we haven't gotten to that point yet. So Jennifer made stops in Arizona. She stayed with a family in Arizona. She got a couple of rides along the way. She stayed at some missions. She stayed at some churches in multiple states. And she also went camping in the western states, in the southwest states, in California, Arizona, and New Mexico. Somewhere about around October, we'll say 16th, 1991, she has a flat tire, and the truck driver, picks her up in Lordsburg, New Mexico, and he drives her to Deming, New Mexico. And as soon as she arrives in Deming on that Wednesday, October 16th, 1991, a local resident patches the tire, and Jennifer starts looking around for some supplies. She goes to the store, and she, as she's wandering around the town, she realizes that there's a church that's open for service on that Wednesday night. So Jennifer wanders into the service, and she befriends the pastor and his wife, and they allow Jennifer to stay at their fifth wheel on their property. So Jennifer takes a shower that night, and she reads a book, she watches television, she has a meal, and she goes to sleep at the home of the pastor and his wife and family in Deming, New Mexico, on October 16, 1991.
Well, one thing that comes to mind, Deming, New Mexico is about 35 miles from the border, right?
Correct.
In proximity. So the next morning, what happens?
Well, the next morning, so the pastor, he needs to be somewhere early, and his wife also has to be someplace for work the following morning on that Thursday morning. So what we do know is that they take Jennifer to McDonald's in Deming, New Mexico for a quick breakfast, and then they take her to the church where her bike was from the night prior, and they bid her farewell. And she talks about wanting to go to Minnesota to go visit a friend who had just started college in Minnesota. And by the time she gets to Deming on October 16th, she did meet a few people who she knew from prior trips who had dissuaded her from traveling any further distance or going any further alone. And they cautioned her and they told her it wouldn't be prudent or wouldn't be wise to be a solo traveler and heading into either the El Paso area or Juarez, and that it would be much safer if she reconsidered and found a group of friends and took that trip at a later date. So whatever they had said to her, it seems as if that had convinced Jennifer that that was the right thing to do and the smart thing to do and the wise thing to do. So she, the pastor, he's since deceased, but his wife is still alive, and she remembers vividly, you know, Jennifer and what she had said, what she had expressed, where she was headed, and where she told them that she would be headed. So it looks like somewhere along that trip, Jennifer had in mind that what she wanted to do on the morning of October 17th, 1991, was to call her mother in Missoula, let her mother know that she had a change of plans. So at 7:52 in the morning, from the payphone outside of the gas station near Pine Street in Deming, Mexico, Jennifer makes a phone call about 14 minutes to her mom. She informs Lynn that she's having a change of plans, that she's going to go in a different direction, lets her know that she loves her, lets her know that that she's learned a lot from the trip, and really what she wanted to do was maybe enroll in some writing courses or maybe some art courses at the University of Montana and way deep into the future. So, you know, Lynn was relieved, her mother, and I think her mother had this sense that, yeah, it was a risky trip, but it was hard to dissuade an ambitious and determined 18-year-old from seeing the world and venturing on their own. And Jennifer just, you know, was willful and decisive, and she felt like she had a plan and a purpose. So it looks like somewhere along the line, she decides that she doesn't want to go into Mexico alone. So she makes the phone call at 7:52 on October 17th, 1991, from the gas station in Deming. And that's the last phone call that she ever made, and the last time she ever talked to her mother. But there are some inconsistencies in some of the information about what happened afterwards. A lot of it is a matter of, you know, of conjecture. But we do know that she did go into that gas station. She had a short interaction or encounter with the clerk, and then depending on his version of events, has her going back, heading back west on her bicycle, perhaps going to a travel agency to get a map or some other information. But she is, in essence, vanished. And she's been gone for a long time, or she hasn't been seen in more than 30 years.
So you just got back, as we mentioned, retracing her steps. What new information did you find?
When you say new information, I guess I've released some information that hadn't been public, and it's new to us. But it's certainly not new to the family, and it's certainly not new to people who are close to the case and know the particulars and the details of the case, like law enforcement. So yes, the information is new to you and I, and to people who have maybe been interested in Jennifer and her case. So I spent some time in Deming and also in Hatch, which is a town nearby. So retrace kind of her steps and her whereabouts on that day, and then also went to the spot where her possessions were found. Many of her possessions were found 1 year later, almost a year later, and they were found in the opposite direction of the direction that she had told her mother that she was going, and then she had told the pastor and his wife that she was going. And she might have been headed to Las Cruces, and there's a church there, and there's also a bus depot. So she might have been going, she was perhaps planning on riding her bicycle for a little bit, kind of enjoying the summer, the spring weather and the October weather, the dry weather, knowing that she could hop on a bus and then head to Minnesota to visit her friend, where there was certainly inclement weather and bad weather. So she had expressed that she was going to Las Cruces, but her possessions were found in the opposite direction, north, in a small town called Hatch, across from a dairy farm. And her possessions were found off of an isolated and sequestered dirt road. And it is a sandy road. I mean, it's hardly can even be described as a road. And the possessions were found stacked neatly and orderly underneath the tarp. So what was found of hers were, her bicycle has never been recovered. There was no sign of Jennifer. Her sleeping bag has never been recovered, but her backpacks contained all of her personal possessions and all of her personal belongings, and everything from her visa passport to her Montana driver's license. So her driver's license was discovered in among the possessions. The folks who had found the backpacks, there's an interesting little side note here, and this might give you some indication as to whether or not this case was taken seriously or how it was treated or perhaps even mistreated. Mm-hmm. Was so 1 year after Jennifer vanishes, her possessions are found in the opposite direction of where it looks like she could have been going, or where she said she was going. So there's a couple who are vacationing. Essentially, they're driving from northern New Mexico down to go visit some family members in El Paso, and they stop in this area, this area called Hatch. And one of their hobbies is that they like to dove hunt. So they were looking on some side roads for a place to dove hunt. And as a husband and wife, and the wife gets out of the car, and not too far from a spot where she goes out to look for a place to use the bathroom, she finds the Jennifer's possessions, and it's alarming. There's something just doesn't feel right about it. She thought immediately that the possessions indicated there was some type of crime scene. But they call the local authorities in Hatch and to inform them of what's been discovered, and the Hatch authorities do not respond and do not take hold of the possessions, because the couple on the way back stopped through in the same area and went to the same location, curious to know if the police in Hatch had confiscated the items. And it turns out they had not confiscated the items. They had not examined the items, and the items were still in the very same location stacked in the very same position. So that's why the couple took all the items and they brought them to their home, and they started to go through these items, and they inventory them, and they realized that the items were so personal. We're talking about driver's licenses and journals too. So one of the miracles of the story is that the journals, think about this, were found under a tarp, intact. A lot of things were weather beaten. Many things were dried. Many things were, she had a couple Bibles. She had two Bibles. One of them was in Spanish because she was learning to speak Spanish conversationally. There was money in there that was dried out. Some things had been eaten or maybe chewed by animals, but the journals were intact. So that's how we know where she was on what day and what route she took. And we know, we have a general sense of where she was between October 1st and October 17th. And she made many phone calls home. So now to bring it up to where we just were. So it's 1992, where it's one year later after the last time she's been seen, and her possessions are found off a very secluded and remote road north of Deming, New Mexico, in a town called Hatch.
So then there were some possible sightings of Jennifer, and then some possible suspects as well in her disappearance.
There have been multiple sightings, and we know that from many cases and many similar situations that the eyewitness accounts and eyewitness testimonials can be very faulty and can be very shaky. It seems like there have been a number of people who've claimed they have seen Jennifer in a variety of different places, and I think, as far as my knowledge of examining law enforcement documents and talking with officers involved in the case, that those sightings appear to be erroneous or mistaken. But there has been a person of interest designated in this case, and that would be the last person to see her alive, who was the gas station attendant in Deming, New Mexico at that time. So, and his name is in the story. And I've released some of the documents, including his police statement. And, there's an old Italian proverb, 10,000 probabilities do not make one fact. So we have a lot of probabilities, and there's dozens and dozens of them. And I've tried to lay those probabilities out in the article. But again, law enforcement and law and the courts and resolution and retribution and justice, they run, they're fact oriented. So I think what we're looking at here is an absence of a certain few facts that could make the case. But law enforcement, was close, and they've said they've been close. The internal documents that I have and the documents that have been provided to me by Lynn and her family are buttressing the fact that the police have always felt like the last person to see her alive might have some intimate knowledge of an intimate familiarity of what happened to her, but the case against him might not be credible enough to get a prosecution. I think that's where we're at, and that's one of the reasons and one of the goals of why I did this story, is to push this back out into the public arena, and with help from people like you who care, and what would like to see this resolved. Hopefully we can keep nudging this in the right direction, and nudging it in the direction that needs to go in, because it certainly needs to be seen in Montana and Missoula law enforcement. They've been extremely cooperative. I've talked to the officer who fielded some of the initial phone calls about the case when the missing persons report was filed even 30 years ago, and there are some officers who, when things have happened in New Mexico, they've been contacted in Missoula, and they're very amenable and cooperative, and they too would like to see some resolution here as well.
Do you think that new technology here could help in solving this case?
And that's an excellent question, and I think that's one of the goals too, is to look into what is what could be processed again, what can be looked at, how can modern technology be applied to past cases and previous cases? And that's one of the questions is, how can technology, our technology, 21st century technology, be applied to a case that's 30 years old? And that's a bygone era when it comes, when it comes to procedures, and when it comes to tactics, and when it comes to DNA, and when it comes to solving these cases and bring them to conclusion. So I do think there's that opportunity. So that's one of the goals is to put a story back out there. And the natural question is like the one you just asked is, what can be looked at? So there's an inventory. I did get a list of the items that are inventoried in New Mexico right now. And it looks like the state of New Mexico is building a new crime lab facility in Santa Fe. And so naturally my question is, what's available related to the case? The inventory list that I was given didn't include some very suspicious items that were also found at the crime scene. Like there were cigarette butts there and Jennifer didn't smoke. There were jars of baby food and other things that were stacked around the tarp, and there were also clothes from other people that were returned to the family from the New Mexico crime lab, and those items that were found at the crime scene that didn't belong to Jennifer were returned to her family, and to my knowledge the family still retains those. So there's an opportunity, and they could be Hail Marys and long shots, but to take some of these items and have them processed and or reprocessed. So I think that opportunity exists, and one of the goals would be, Missoula and Montana would be able to encourage or New Mexico to do that. And I think that's how it's worked over the last, initially when it wasn't officially designated as a homicide, now it is, but when it was only officially designated as a disappearance, I know, Missoula, the county attorney, and the police officers here were really pushing New Mexico to process some of the material. And so I think having another state asking and requesting and having that relationship between the two states is something that I won't be able to do. So I think the goal is always to use some type of influence, because there's always a difference between influence and authority, right? I mean, so influence is, you and I have influence because we can do good things. I mean, I could write a story and then you can care enough to highlight it. And then we together are putting this out, this information. So we have a little bit of influence, but the authority would be law enforcement. So if we can use our influence to get this case to where authority resides, that's a great goal. And I think that's what we're doing now. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, what do you think most likely happened here?
Well, I think if the fact that Jennifer's story is listed on the New Mexico State Police cold case homicides could give us a pretty good indication of what they think happened to her, and sadly and lamentably, what I think most likely happened to her too. And there's been some speculation, and that maybe, she ran away, or that she didn't want to be found, or she took up another identity and is living under an assumed name. I don't believe that that's the case. And I've heard rumors maybe she, got lost in a mine shaft, or got hit by a tractor trailer, and there's other horrific things that could have happened. But I don't believe that this is the case. And I think, after releasing a lot of this new information about the prime suspect, I think it's not irrefutable. I think it lays out a case to reasonably reopen the case and investigate this person. And I think it also, the story that I wrote gives the reader a reasonable suspicion as to where my thoughts lie on this case too, and sadly that would be that this would be a cold case, mm-hmm. an abduction and a murder.
And again, the article was just published in the Montana Press just fascinating, a really great article to get out there. And you have researched so many unsolved cases and murders. You have a book out right now, and we're going to talk about that in another podcast, Montana Murders. I'm almost halfway through it.
Eye-opening.
It's just amazing. So I know we're going to talk about that again in another podcast. So what's next for you? Do you plan to write a book about this? I know we want the case to be reopened. What's next?
Well, I think as far as what's next for Jennifer Pantella and I, as far as this relationship as being the writer and the subject, is I really would like the story to be seen and to be heard and to be felt and to be shared in outside of Montana and New Mexico. So really the most immediate goal and the most pressing is to have the story, you know, reprinted and shared. I contacted the Deming Headlight and the Deming newspaper about running parts of it, or running it, you know, running the whole thing, or running whatever they would like. So I think really my goal right now is essentially, you know, for lack of a better word, sick other media outlets and organizations on it. So now we're at 30 years. I know we love numbers, we love round numbers, we love anniversaries. 30 just seems like the right number and the right time. So I think my immediate goal for this case in particular is to illuminate it and to share it and to tell it and to speak it, you know, as much as we can, as much as I can over this year and this period. That's why we did release the story on what would be Jennifer's 48th birthday, which was this past Easter, just a few days ago. And I think on the larger scale, I have several other stories that'd be curious to look into. And if I feel like I can uncover new information and share new information, and I have the opportunity to use my material and mental resources to do something that I think has that could be beneficial for families and help bring resolution, I'll continue to do that. You know, so I do have a list of other names and other stories that I'd be honored to delve into.
So if anyone has any information that they think could help with this case, what do you recommend for them?
Well, you know, that's a good question, you know, and I was thinking about that, and I know that Jennifer is listed on the New Mexico Cold Case Homicide website, and I didn't memorize the email address, but someone could go there and leave a tip, and also they could also contact the in Missoula too. You can contact Guy Baker at the Missoula Police Department, because there is a reward of up to a certain amount of money, depending on how actionable the intelligence is or how actionable the tip is. So if there is a tip and there's resolution, so the amount would be greater. So you can contact, you have several different options as far as that goes too. And the New Mexico Cold Case Homicide website has a tip line that is that's also done by email, so you can leave a tip that way as well. So there's a couple of different options as far as that goes.
And I had a personal question. In reading through the whole story, I noticed that there was a farm laborer named Henry possibly become a witness, but then this police officer had the same last name, this police officer, that there were some questions surrounding how he was handling the case. And right. I got thinking, are the two related?
Right. Well, you know, would not answer my questions. All that material came from internal emails and emails he had sent the family. I had contacted Ed Apodaca. Now, he's a private investigator now. And multiple times I just tried to talk to him about this case. And as I think I mentioned, he would not comment. And I went and looked into everyone's related in these small areas. That's a great question. That was one that was kind of a glaring thing that jumped out at me. One thing I didn't mention is that I did a records check with a private investigator on Henry Apodaca's vehicles, and one of them did match a 1953 Chevy truck. So I don't know if it could have been two people perhaps that were involved in this, or there's still a lot of questions and there's still a little more material that I just wasn't released because I didn't release. But I don't know. Something's not right, as you can tell. Yeah. And especially with some of the comments, I mean, or they're just, it's just bizarre. I mean, bizarre that Eddie would say these things to the family. And then he would also write these things out and he wrote them in long form. He wrote them in letters. I have all of his emails. I have some of his internal memos where he's talking about, you know, he wants to get Chewie to confess, and that Chewie's not a bad guy. I mean, that Chewie, he lost a baby, and his parents were nice. He went to jail. He's paid his debt. You know, I think he'll leave that anonymous note. I'll get that anonymous note. So there's something not right, and I think we don't know what that is, but someone else does. And I think when they see that, the natural tendency would be, okay, well, something. Obviously, you have this Ed Apodaca. There is a Henry. Maybe they're not related, but did someone? How's Chewie? Someone knows that. Someone could know. There was another woman who said that she had seen Jennifer and two men, perhaps at the Quick Pick store, the grocery store in Hatch. Several witnesses, and one of them testified. One of them said that he had a bracelet. Chewie had a bracelet that Jennifer was wearing around that time, and there's other things that don't make sense, but someone else knows that someone who is in that community. I've reached out to other people, even in Chewie's family. I sent his sister letters. I go to the family members a lot. I sent, and I said, well, maybe you can help. Maybe now is the right time. Chewie's sister, who lives in El Paso, somebody has to know, and there's a link. Yeah, and what that link is, could it be Ed? But since it's never been released and it's never been made public, no one has had the opportunity to examine it and make that connection. So that's why I try to make all those connections and release all that information, because it seems like it's there, and maybe someone has to connect the dots. So yeah, I noticed that too with the name. I looked at that. Yeah, I thought, well, this is maybe it means nothing, but maybe it's just a common surname. But no, I thought the same thing. So.
A lot of different avenues to go. Well, thank you so much, Brian. And I know we could talk so much more about this case. And I hope it all works out in the end.